From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we speak with the Boston Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning legal correspondent, Charlie Savage. He's been covering recent changes in the Justice Department, including the firings and replacements of U.S. attorneys. One of the people who oversaw the firings is Monica Goodling, a graduate of the Regent University School of Law, a Christian law school founded by Pat Robertson. We'll speak with the dean of Regent Law School, Jeffrey Brow. Later, we'll listen back to a 1986 interview with Jerry Falwell. The founder of the Moral Majority died yesterday at the age of 73. And book critic Maureen Corrigan will review Don DeLillo's new novel, Falling Man. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Charlie Savage, is the legal correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's been reporting on changes in the Justice Department under the Bush administration and writing about the investigation into the firings of 9 U.S. attorneys. The positions are supposed to be nonpartisan appointments. The Bush administration says the attorneys were fired for performance reasons, but Congress is investigating whether the firings were politically motivated so that the attorneys could be replaced by people more in sync with the Bush administration. Savage won a Pulitzer Prize last month for his articles on President Bush's record-setting use of presidential signing statements, which have allowed him to constitutionally challenge new laws and bypass them without having to issue a veto. Savage is now completing a book focusing on the expansion of executive powers under the Bush administration. It will be published in September. Charlie Savage, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on that Pulitzer.
Thank you very much.
You recently wrote a story on the Regent University School of Law. This is a school that was founded by televangelist Pat Robertson. How does Regent connect to the larger story of changes in the Justice Department and the firing and replacing of U.S. attorneys?
Regent University School of Law connects to the U.S. attorney firings and replacement affair in two ways. The first way is through the person of Monica Goodling, the former Justice Department liaison to the White House, who played a central role in helping evaluate which U.S. attorneys ought to be fired and who they ought to be replaced with, and who was in regular communication with the White House, notably the office of Karl Rove, during this process. She later resigned. The second way in which Regent University connects to the scandal is in its unusual success in placing graduates, both of the law school and of the larger university, in government jobs of influence. Under the Bush administration, this university as a whole has placed at least 150 of its graduates into government jobs, according to the university itself. And that's interesting because Regent itself is a very new university. It's a school that is still struggling to build an academic reputation. Its law school is ranked as a Tier 4 school by U.S. News and World Report, which is the lowest possible score. And it's not the kind of place that you would normally suspect that many, many, many graduates would find success at the upper reaches. Part of the U.S. attorney hiring and firing affair has been this larger question of accusations of politicization at the Justice Department. That is to say, of hiring changes over the last 6 or 7 years under the Bush administration, which critics charged have placed ideology and partisan credentials above qualifications and credentials when deciding who should be filling these powerful positions of government responsibility.
Have people raised questions about whether Monica Goodling was qualified for her position in the Justice Department, or whether it seemed that she was hired to promote a certain agenda?
Yes, one of the themes of the controversy over the last few months has been charges and accusations by Democrats and other critics of what has happened in the Justice Department, along the lines that people who are not qualified for the jobs, they say, are being given positions of great responsibility because they have the right ideology under the administration's view, if not the level of experience or the credentials. And so at a recent Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, for example, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, one a former U.S. attorney himself, asked the question, should we be concerned about the experience level of the people who are making these very important decisions about hiring and firing U.S. attorneys? Neither Monica Goodling nor Kyle Sampson, the former chief of staff to Alberto Gonzalez, who was also a leader in this effort, had significant prosecutorial experience. And in the case of Monica Goodling as well, she came from a law school which did not give her the usual credential one would have for a high-ranking job in the Justice Department.
You've written about some of the hiring practices that were changed under the Bush administration that relate to the scandal surrounding the firing and replacing of U.S. attorneys. And this goes back to 2002 under Attorney General John Ashcroft, who changed some longstanding rules for hiring lawyers to fill vacancies in the ranks. How did he change the rules in 2002?
Prior to 2002, political appointees had much less control over who would be hired to fill a vacancy in the career ranks of the Justice Department. And in the Civil Rights Division, for example, where voting rights laws are affected or are enforced, committees of veteran career attorneys would screen applicants and conduct interviews and essentially decide who to hire when there was a vacancy. Political appointees had to sign off on their recommendation, but they always accepted it under both Republican and Democratic administrations. After 2002, when Attorney General Ashcroft made this change, the career hiring committees were disbanded, and political appointees did the entire hiring process from start to finish. And this caused some dramatic changes in the profile of who was being hired to enforce laws, especially civil rights laws. And it connects to the U.S. attorney scandal, especially through the voting rights section of the Civil Rights Division. Because in the beginning of 2003, a lawyer named Bradley Schlossman was given the position of being the political appointee who oversaw the voting rights section, along with a few others. And career officials from that section say that he took an unusual interest in hiring decisions and just basically took over control of the whole process, taking advantage of this new policy that Attorney General Ashcroft had put out. And under Mr. Schlossman, the profile of attorneys who are being hired to enforce voting rights laws in order to protect minorities shifted dramatically. Prior experience in civil rights fell. Half of the lawyers that he hired listed the Federalist Society on their resumes or were members of the Republican National Lawyers Association. And according to McClatchy newspapers, he was also telling applicants to leave such markers off of their resumes in order to get hired, so the numbers may be even higher than that. In addition, the quality of the law school from which the hires were coming plunged. In the 2 years before Mr. Schlossman took over and the policy was changed, the average law school ranking, according to U.S. News and World Report, was 15 for new hires to that section. In the 3 years after he took over hiring, it dropped to 65 on average. Then, in March of 2006, Mr. Schlossman was moved out of the voting rights section and installed in Western Missouri as the first new replacement U.S. attorney. And so his record in voting rights law in the 3 years before that change connects to the U.S. attorney's firing scandal, both because he was the first replacement U.S. attorney and because because we know that vote fraud prosecutions were a major part of the motivation behind the replacements. That is to say, the desire on the part of Karl Rove to bring more voter fraud investigations against Democrats in battleground states.
Another part of the story that you've written about is how under Attorney General John Ashcroft, the Justice Department tried to find ways to replace U.S. attorneys without having them go through Senate confirmation. And they managed to change the rules on that. How?
Well, the main aspect of this is that when the USA Patriot Act was reauthorized finally in March of 2006 after a long fight, there had been slipped into it by a Republican staffer in the drafting of the bill at the request of the Justice Department, a then unnoticed provision that gave the Attorney General the power to permanently replace U.S. attorneys without Senate confirmation. And that was a piece of the puzzle. The emails and such have shown that have since been released by the department as far as enabling them then to put people into U.S. attorney positions who would not otherwise be likely to survive vetting by the Senate, notably in Arkansas, Tim Griffin, who was an aide to Karl Rove and an opposition researcher for the Republican National Committee, who had no support from the local senators, not the type of person who would normally become a U.S. attorney had he had to go through Senate confirmation. And what you referred to under Attorney General Ashcroft is sort of unknown how this what I'm about to talk to connects to this, but I found an interesting memo from the Office of Legal Counsel a couple years earlier, I think in 2003, in which there was early brainstorming going on about how to replace U.S. attorneys without Senate confirmation, or that is to say, how long they could put a replacement U.S. attorney in without having to worry about Senate confirmation. Because under the rules as they then existed prior to the Patriot Act change, they could only do so for 120 days. But they had figured out a creative way to call someone first an interim and then an acting U.S. attorney and get nearly a year of U.S. attorney service out of them without any Senate vetting. It's unknown, however, to me at least, whether that early brainstorming connects in any way to what followed a couple years later.
Now, the thing that was slipped into the reauthorization of the Patriot Act that said that these replacement attorneys would not require Senate confirmation, do you think that most of the senators and congressmen who voted for this bill realized that that was in there?
No senator or member of Congress has stepped forward to say that they knew that was in there. And all of them who have spoken about it have said they did not know it was there. And they both chambers have since, in overwhelming bipartisan votes, voted to repeal that change. The bill has not become law yet because it's still in conference committee. But it's clear that Congress as a whole, without regard to party, is outraged that happened.
The larger question here is, has the Bush administration consciously tried to make the staff of the Justice Department and the U.S. attorneys fit the political agenda of the Bush administration, even in positions that are supposed to be politically nonpartisan? You have been doing research into this question in various areas. One of the areas was the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, in which you found evidence that not only was the staff changing, but the agenda was changing too. Would you just sum up that for us?
Certainly. Last year, I used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain the resumes of successful hires to the Civil Rights Division over the last 6 years in three sections. And what I found was that starting in 2003, after this change in procedures had gone through giving political appointees greater control of who would be hired, the profile of the attorneys being hired changed dramatically. They were much less likely to have prior experience in traditional civil rights enforcement. To the extent they did have that experience, it was just as often people who had been fighting against traditional civil rights enforcement, that is to say, defending companies and municipalities against discrimination lawsuits and so forth. And they were much more likely to have very conservative credentials, such as membership in the Federalist Society, the Republican National Lawyers Association, Christian activist groups. And along with that change, the focus of the Civil Rights Division has also been shifting. They've been putting more resources into religious discrimination lawsuits, especially defending Christians against religious discrimination. They've been putting less emphasis on what used to be the bread and butter of the division, which would be large lawsuits alleging systematic discrimination against African Americans.
Is there any way of knowing how permanent the hiring changes in the Justice Department will be?
Well, this is interesting. Just a few weeks ago, the Justice Department announced internally that they were going back to the old way of doing hiring in the Civil Rights Division, at least, which is to say they were now going to have committees of career staffers, once again screening applications and recommending whom to hire. However, when one talks to the numerous, in some cases, 30-year veterans of these divisions that have all sort of fled in the last few years, taken buyouts, quit, and otherwise been driven out, they're skeptical about whether this actually means that everything got rolled back, because the career ranks are different today. than they were in 2001. Very, you know, many of the long-standing traditional career civil rights lawyers have left, and they've been replaced already with very conservative lawyers. And so a career hiring committee made up of Federalist Society members is not going to produce, they say, a remarkably different result than what we've seen with the political appointees, the technically political appointees, the last few years.
My guest is Charlie Savage, legal correspondent for the Boston Globe. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Charlie Savage, legal correspondent for the Boston Globe. Last month, he won the Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. Recently, he's been writing about changes in the Justice Department under the Bush administration, including the firings of 9 U.S. attorneys. Let me get back to Regent University and the Regent University Law School, founded by Pat Robertson. There is a very specifically Christian mission to the teaching. For instance, what's the mission at the law school?
Well, the law school, like the whole university, shares as its motto, Christian leadership to change the world. When Pat Robertson founded this school, which was originally the Christian Broadcasting Network school and shares a campus with his televangelist studios, he had the idea of wanting an institution where Christian activists could come and study to take up positions of responsibility and influence in the world where they would be able to spread Christian values, biblical values as they understood them, and try to change society in those places where they believed that secular law deviated from God's law.
You spent time there for one of your stories. What do you find interesting about the university now and the connections that it has with the Bush administration?
Well, Regent University itself has bragged on their website that they, though they are a small and young school, have 150 alumni serving in the Bush administration. And that is a remarkably large number. It was, yes, I did go down and spend a day at Regent, and I talked to a lot of students and professors and the dean, who I guess you're going to have on your show. I found it was a fascinating day. There's a number of interesting things you can say about Regent, one of which is, though it has been much ridiculed in recent months, in part because of its very low ranking in the U.S. news polls and other things, it's actually getting much better. They've put a huge amount of money into recruiting higher qualified students in recent years, and they've overhauled their curriculum, and they've started to win national law student competitions, which normally are won by Ivy Leaguers. And they're really a school that's on the rise. And so whatever else you may think about them, I think it's an error to not to take them seriously and their graduates seriously. Now, that I mean that especially about the students who are there now, because the students who were there in the 90s, before all these changes were made, really struggled. And I think the wake-up call, Dean Brow told me, to make these changes was when the majority of their students couldn't pass the bar exam in 1999, which was the year that Monica Goodling graduated from Regent. I also find it interesting just to sit in on their classes. They open each class with a 10-minute devotional prayer or sermon, sometimes led by students, sometimes led by professors. And then they go in and they have what is essentially a regular law class, especially in those areas in which there's not really much to say religiously about what's happening, such as, you know, standards of evidence in criminal law and so forth. On the other hand, I also sat through a constitutional law class in which the subject was substantive due process, especially as it related to laws that used to ban interracial marriage and were struck down in the Loving v. Virginia case. And it was very interesting because they were, as in any law school class, they were trying to just sort of figure out the basis on which the judges had decided that that law was unconstitutional and so forth. But hanging over the entire debate was the higher discussion was the issue of gay marriage today. Obviously, anyone who goes to Regent, or almost everyone who goes to Regent, is against gay marriage because they think it's contrary to biblical values and should not be, you know, legalized in America. And so they were, but on the other hand, no one there thinks that people of different races should not be able to get married. And so they were struggling with how do we accept the Loving v. Virginia precedent and say that case was rightly decided, because certainly we're all on the same side on that, without also extending that to gay people who might want to get married. And so there was, and it's not necessarily the professor was presenting that, but even the students in the class discussion were coming up with, well, maybe this is how we distinguish the two. Maybe this is other approach is how we say this case was okay, but it goes no further. And so I don't think that's a discussion you might have heard in a different law school, or maybe it would have gone the other direction if it was a more liberal student body. I just thought that was a very interesting approach to what it's like to be a Regent Law student.
Well, Charlie Savage, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Charlie Savage is the legal correspondent for the Boston Globe. We'll hear from the dean of the Regent University School of Law in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Hotels.com, with virtual tours, customer reviews, and over 70,000 properties to choose from, online or at 800-3-HOTELS. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to a 1986 interview with Reverend Jerry Falwell, the founder of the Moral Majority, died yesterday at the age of 73. Also, we speak with the dean of the Regent University School of Law, a Christian law school founded by Pat Robertson, and Maureen Corrigan reviews Don DeLillo's new novel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Monica Goodling, a former top aide to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, was one of the officials who oversaw the firing of U.S. attorneys. She resigned after refusing to testify to Congress, taking the Fifth Amendment, which protects against self-incrimination. She graduated in 1999 from Regent University School of Law, a Christian law school founded by televangelist Pat Robertson. Charlie Savage, the Pulitzer Prize-winning legal correspondent for the Boston Globe, writes, quote, "Goodling has become the face of Regent overnight and drawn a harsh spotlight to the administration's hiring of officials educated at smaller, conservative schools with sometimes marginal academic reputations," unquote. Former Attorney General John Ashcroft teaches several weeks a year at Regent Law School. The campus houses the American Center for Law and Justice, which is headed by Jay Sekulow, who was picked by the White House to be an advisor on judicial nominations. The center's website says, "Take action. Don't let Congress silence Christians." My guest is the dean of the Regent University School of Law, Jeffrey Brauch. Dean Brauch, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
One of the mission statements of Regent's University School of Law is to turn out lawyers who will, quote, bring to bear the will of our Creator, Almighty God, upon legal education and the legal profession. What does that mean?
Well, I think it reflects that there are principles of justice that we believe transcend, let's say, a particular political majority at a particular time. There are eternal principles of justice, and as we teach our law students, we want to explore those and talk with our students about those during their education.
How do you teach law pertaining to the rights of gay people?
Well, we're going to look at the law as it exists. We'll talk about the Constitution. In all our constitutional law classes, we begin with the text of the Constitution. We'll talk about that, and we'll address the cases then that have come down from the U.S. Supreme Court on all issues, including issues like that, so that our classes would cover Lawrence versus Texas, the sodomy case out of Texas, just like any law school would.
Is there a but at the end? But because I'm assuming that you think that there should be no gay marriage and that perhaps there should be laws making gay sexual unions illegal.
Well, I think as we do in all our classes, we're going to study the law as it exists, see what the legal framework is out there, but we will examine biblical texts, we'll talk about natural law, and consider, you know, how ought we to approach an area like this.
Regent University and Regent University School of Law was founded by Pat Robertson, and he has said some very extreme things in the past few years, including that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon suffered his stroke as, you know, God's retribution for his policies. What has the repercussions been at the school of some of Pat Robertson's more recent extreme statements?
Well, Dr. Robertson has been a great leader of Regent University. I can tell you he's a person of real vision. The beauty of the campus, the excellence with which we do things stem from his conviction. We ought to be excellent in all we do. And so I've been very thankful to have him as a leader of the university, as a leader in the law school. I will tell you, he, like all people, has views on different topics. And again, Regent is a place of diversity of views and diversity of opinions. I think you would find that our faculty and students display that diversity.
What are the odds I'd find any students who were gay or thought that abortion should be legal?
I think you're going to find students of many different backgrounds on all kinds of issues.
On those included?
I think perhaps.
When you talk about, you know, bringing like a Christian worldview to law, what does that mean in terms of separation of church and state?
There's no question that the institutional separation of church and state is an important concept, and we talk about that a lot at Regent Law School. But I think over time, the idea of separation of church and state has morphed into a concept, or at least is discussed as a concept by some, that meant something very different from that, and that is that religious belief and faith have no impact in public life. And that's wrong. It has always been wrong as part of this country's history. People of religious conviction have always brought their religious convictions to bear in public policy, but that's very different from saying that there ought to be a merger of church and state or an institutional merger of those two.
Monica Goodling, who's at the center of the scandal surrounding the fired and replaced U.S. attorneys and served as the White House liaison for Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, and she was one of the people who oversaw the firings and replacements of U.S. attorneys. She was a graduate of the Regent University Law School, and because of that, that's kind of giving your law school a lot of attention, and I'm wondering what impact that's having on the law school.
No doubt we've had a lot of attention on the law school recently. But I have to tell you, it's been an opportunity to share many good things about the law school that people don't know about us. The kind of excellence that we have in our program. I think it's been a chance to share, for example, that Regent Law students won this year's ABA Negotiation National Championship. Out of 220 teams in the nation, our team finished first in that competition. Harvard won it last year. Regent won it this year. So I think it's given us an opportunity to share that there's great quality. Our students are bright men and women. They're learning outstanding legal skills. They're going to be great lawyers. And so the attention has given us a chance to share some of those things.
Well, Dean Brock, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed being here.
Jeffrey Brock is the dean of the Regent University School of Law. Coming up, we listen back to a 1986 interview with Reverend Jerry Falwell, the founder of The Moral Majority, died yesterday. This is Fresh Air. We're going to listen back to a 1986 interview I recorded with the Reverend Jerry Falwell. He died yesterday at the age of 73. As his New York Times obituary said today, as much as anyone, Falwell helped create the religious right as a political force, defined the issues that would energize it for decades, and cemented its ties to the Republican Party. Falwell founded the Christian lobbying group The Moral Majority in 1979, which was credited with playing a significant role in helping Ronald Reagan win the presidency by a landslide in 1980. Falwell was the pastor of Thomas Road Baptist Church, which grew to a megachurch in his hometown Lynchburg, Virginia, where he also founded Liberty University. Through his program, The Old Time Gospel Hour, Falwell became one of the most influential televangelists. He made one of his most controversial statements shortly after September 11th, when he said that pagans, abortionists, feminists, gays, lesbians, the ACLU, all of whom had tried to secularize America, helped make the terrorist attacks possible. He later said he didn't mean to blame them for the attacks. In 1986, I asked Jerry Falwell how he was born again.
At age 18, as a second-year student at Lynchburg College, training to go into journalism or engineering, and I wasn't sure which. I didn't like public speaking, so both of those appealed to me. I began listening to a radio broadcast, Dr. Charles E. Fuller. He was really the pioneer in gospel broadcasting, starting about the same time radio did, and stayed on the air about 50 years. I heard Dr. Fuller preaching the gospel, the message of the death, the burial, the resurrection of Christ, and the fact that all men are sinners and need a reconciliation with God in and through the Lord Jesus Christ and His gospel. And it was really through listening to that Sunday morning broadcast on radio. My mother would leave the radio on as she went off to church. My father was an agnostic and did not allow her to force us to go to church. Through hearing him, I became very much aware of my personal spiritual need, began looking for a church that preached what I've been hearing Dr. Fuller preach. And on Sunday night, January 20, 1952, walked inside a little church in my hometown and heard the gospel, received the Lord as my personal Savior. And that's been 34 years and 2 months ago, and that, of course, redirected my life.
And you became a minister instead of a journalist or an engineer.
I did, that fall. That fall of 1952, I became a student at Baptist Bible College in Springfield, Missouri. 4 years later, came back to my hometown, Lynchburg, Virginia, and started the ministries.
Now, initially, you were not a political minister.
Preached against it, actually.
You preached against it, that's right. And you have a kind of now famous speech called Ministers and Marches.
I tried to buy it back, but I walk into it in every press conference.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, this was written in 1965, and I'll just quote a little bit of it. In that speech in which you spoke out
against ministers' involvement in social and political events.
Right, and specifically at that time, the civil rights ministers mm-hmm. who were involved in political mm-hmm. events. And you wrote, as far as the relationship of the church to the world, it can be expressed as simply as the three words which Paul gave to Timothy, preach the word. And you wrote, nowhere are we commissioned to reform the externals. We're not told to wage wars against bootleggers, liquor stores, gamblers, murderers, prostitutes, racketeers, prejudiced persons or institutions, or any other existing evil as such. Believing the Bible as I do, I would find it impossible to stop preaching the pure saving gospel of Jesus Christ and begin doing anything else, including fighting communism or participating in civil rights reforms. So what changed your mind?
A number of things, but I would say more than anything else, the Roe v. Wade 1973, legalizing abortion on demand, probably was a straw that broke the camel's back. But other things, the drug epidemic in the country, the breakdown of the family, just a lot of moral decadence that I felt many of us, because of our deafening silence from the pulpit, were responsible for.
In 1979, you founded the Moral Majority.
Yes.
You were approached by a group of leading conservatives, including Richard Viguerie and Paul Weyrich. Why do you think they approached you as opposed to another leading fundamentalist to help found the Moral Majority?
They knew, first of all, by my own inquiries, that I was looking for some expertise, some help in determining what I, as a pastor of a local church, could do to impact the nation morally. And I had corresponded with them, called them, until one day, I forgot who initiated the meeting, we decided let's have a meeting together and talk about all of this. And it was in that meeting that Paul Weyrich, in a several-hour-long meeting, said, "Now, Jerry, there's no question about it. There is in this country a moral majority that agrees with the traditional values, lowercase m. And when he said that, in my heart, that's the bell rang, and I said, that's going to be the name of the organization we're going to start. And we founded it in June of 79.
Let me ask you if you'd still stand by some quotes that you made several years ago. One is, and this is a quote from the Washington Post, that you wanted to turn this into a Christian nation.
No, what I said was that this is a Christian nation. That's a Supreme Court edict, 1892. Christian nation in the sense that a majority of the population would profess the Christian faith, Catholic, Protestant, etc. What our critics use, and that's why we're very careful when we use that term, what they use against us is that we mean that like Italy, like some other country, England, that has a church, a state church, that we want to create a state church and then make it difficult for everyone who's not a Christian. That's the last thing we want. We believe in pluralism. We defend the rights even of Madeleine O'Hare and non-believers. We certainly believe that that's what America is all about, but we do still believe that the majority of this country would be committed to the Judeo-Christian ethic.
And this quote, that Jews are, quote, spiritually blind and desperately in need of their Messiah and Savior.
I believe that Jesus Christ is not just a way, the truth, the life. And it isn't a Jewish issue. Someone asked the question, that was my answer. And I put it in the book, Jerry Falwell of the Jews, that Merrill Simon wrote. But I believe that all persons who do not have a personal relationship with God through Christ are missing a spiritual dimension in their lives.
One of the techniques that you've used to raise money is through direct mail. And I'd like to read an example of a piece of direct mail that you sent out in August 13th, 1981. And I read, "Dear friend, I refuse to stop speaking out against the sin of homosexuality. With God as my witness, I pledge that I will continue to expose the sin of homosexuality to the people of this nation. I believe that the massive homosexual revolution is always a symptom of a nation coming under the judgment of God. Recently, 250,000 homosexuals marched in the streets of San Francisco. The homosexuals are on the march in this country. Please remember, homosexuals do not reproduce, they recruit. And many of them are after my children and your children. This is one major reason why we must keep the old-time gospel hour alive. The old-time gospel hour is one of the few major ministries in America crying out against militant homosexuals. So don't delay. Let me hear from you immediately. I will be anxiously awaiting your reply. P.S. Let me repeat, a massive homosexual revolution can bring the judgment of God upon this nation. Our children must not be recruited into a profane lifestyle."
I agree with that. I believe that homosexuality is a perverted lifestyle. I feel that AIDS in our society is the judgment of God against misbehavior, against sin, not against the homosexual, but against sin. God loves people. He hates sin. And I feel that heterosexual behavior is exactly the same. The reason we have so many social diseases in our society, syphilis, gonorrhea, etc., it is because we have violated the laws of God, which clearly teach one man for one woman for one lifetime.
My question is, was this an effective piece of fundraising literature?
I have no idea. That was 5 years ago.
Right, and, you can't tell
I,
which
I
got
doubt
which.
That it raised any funds. But it,
it was
a
fundraising letter. That was its intention.
I was listening. I don't know what it said there. I was simply saying, as that went out, that this is where we are. We hope that you will pray for us. We hope that you will support us. And, you know, unfortunately, in many of our pulpits today, we have just, as I said earlier, a deafening silence on traditional values, on the family situation in our country. We're so afraid that we'll offend somebody that we don't say what we need to say.
The family has for years been one of the most important issues for you, both politically and spiritually. And I'll confess to you that I was really surprised to hear about your family when you were growing up, because your father had never been to church, and mm-hmm. he'd been a bootlegger and became an alcoholic afterwards. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I grew up in Lynchburg, Virginia, born there in 1933. My father was an agnostic. His father was an atheist. My mother was a very godly woman, but my father would not allow her to force our family to go to church. And there were five of us. I have a twin brother. So we didn't go. And I didn't own a Bible when I became a Christian. It was absolutely, as far as I was concerned, I was spiritually ignorant. It was through a radio broadcast, as I said earlier, that I came to know the Lord. And at our home, we were close. There was love one for another. And to this present day, those who are still alive, we're very close together. But unlike my wife, who grew up in a solid Christian family, there were no spiritual values. For me, when I became a Christian, I made a determination in my heart that if ever I marry and we have a family, my children are going to get what I did not get. So we have three today, a daughter who's trained to be a medical doctor and a very dynamic Christian girl, Jeannie, she's 21. We have a son, Jerry, who finishes law school at Virginia next year. He's going to be a lawyer, and a son, 19, who's going to be a preacher. So we're glad and thankful that we have been able to give to our children what I did not have in my earlier life, and I hope that they will give to their families the same values.
Now, your father, I understand it, became an alcoholic in his later years and also killed his brother in an act of self-defense and ended up dying of cirrhosis of the liver. How did that affect you? Were you ashamed of that?
Impact.
Did the neighbors gossip about that?
Oh, no, never. I wasn't ashamed of it. I was just grieved over the fact that at age 55, when I was 15 and really loved my dad, that I lost him over this stupid habit of the excessive use of alcoholic beverages. And before I became a Christian, I determined that that's not going to happen to me. And my mother lived till 8 years ago. She was 82 years old when she passed away. But it did have an impact. You know, we in our family, I didn't remember when my father and his brother had their shootout. That was before I was born. But it was all because of really a reckless and lawless lifestyle. And my father was very wealthy. He had everything he needed and a successful businessman nationally. But also in an era coming up in the teens and the 20s and the 30s when the rich and the powerful ran everything. And my father was one of them. Well, I also saw that kind of unchecked power and influence and determined as a Christian later that I want my children to have just a totally different image of what the world and life and the responsibilities to others are all about.
You're very certain of your views, and I wonder if you ever have any doubts, and what I'm thinking is, or if there are ambiguities that trouble you, and what I'm thinking is, in the first half of the 60s, you were still a segregationist. You were already a minister at your church.
As was the entire South. I grew up, I was born and raised in Virginia.
I guess what I'm asking here is that you're already a minister, you already had established a personal relationship with God, and you said that in the mid-60s at some point that God basically made it clear to you that segregation was no longer the route to follow. But if you could have been practicing something or believing something when you had already become a minister, is it possible that you're not absolutely right now?
You see, all of the Christian life is growth. And in my Christian life, of course, I was born in a segregation society in the South. And I'm glad to say that it was the Spirit of God in my study of the Scriptures as a young Christian that taught me that discrimination is wrong. And when I came out and began baptizing blacks at Thomas Road Church, we were the first church in Lynchburg doing it.
I guess I'm not asking you to defend your views on segregation.
I'm
asking if there's any room for doubt, and if you feel that you have any doubts or if there's
about.
Any ambiguities.
I've never doubted once God. I've never doubted the Bible, never doubted biblical truth. I often doubt myself, and all of us should.
My interview with Jerry Falwell was recorded in 1986. He died yesterday at the age of 73. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Don DeLillo's new novel, Falling Man. This is Fresh Air. Ever since word got out that Don DeLillo was working on a novel about September 11th, anticipation has been building. After all, DeLillo has claimed plots and conspiracies as his literary subject. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of DeLillo's new novel, Falling Man.
Can you write a novel about September 11th and sidestep its most horrific images? The smash of the planes, the collapse of the Twin Towers? Don DeLillo leaves that question dangling in readers' minds until the final 10 pages of his much-anticipated novel, Falling Man. It's not until the last chapter that DeLillo puts aside whatever misgivings he has about being exploitative and goes for broke, giving us not one, but two claustrophobic insider versions of the climactic moments of 9/11. First, we're in the mind of one of the hijackers, blood-stained, box-cutter in hand, strapped into his jump seat. At the explosive instant of impact, our perspective leaps. Now we're in the mind of an office worker inside the South Tower, feeling it impossibly lurch. No doubt because DeLillo knows he's so good at summoning up these you-are-there scenes of the unthinkable. The prime example in his work is the Kennedy assassination scene in Libra. He hesitates to dramatize the still raw events of September 11th. We readers know DeLillo has qualms about evoking 9/11 because he tells us so through the virtually neon-lit symbol that gives this novel its name. Falling Man, as DeLillo imagines him, is a controversial performance artist who begins mysteriously appearing around New York City shortly after the horror. Dressed in a business suit and tethered to a safety harness, Falling Man jumps from high public places, reenacting the awful plunge of office workers from the towers, much as DeLillo, as a different kind of artist, performs the same feat in his novel. Some New Yorkers find the figure of Falling Man an exhibitionist, while others hail him as a new chronicler of the Age of Terror. DeLillo obviously is anticipating the same kind of angry responses to this novel that Libra stirred up. Namely, how dare a novelist help himself to real-life catastrophe as a fictional subject? It's a legitimate objection, I guess, but as a reader, I had no qualms about surrendering myself to the voyeuristic horror of DeLillo's last pages. By the time I reached that last chapter of Falling Man, I was just so grateful to feel anything, as opposed to the vacancy I'd been lost in throughout the rest of the novel. For page after muted page, Falling Man catalogs post-traumatic numbness. The main character, Keith Neudecker, who's that office worker trapped in the South Tower, spends the days, months, and years following 9/11 tamping down his terror by losing himself in walking and marathon poker games. His estranged wife, Leanne, runs a writing workshop for Alzheimer's patients whose memories are dwindling down to a last bare state. Leanne's mother, a retired art professor, stares and stares at a minimalist painting of bottles that look vaguely like the Twin Towers. Taken together, this collage of shell-shocked images makes DeLillo's novel read like some World War I poetry by Siegfried Sassoon or Wilfred Owen, except that their poems were powerful in part precisely because they were poems. Shell shock alone isn't enough to sustain a novel, even a thin novel like this one. What fiction about 9/11 has a responsibility to do is to enlighten readers, to take us beyond our own memories of the day, our conventional wisdom, even the gripping reportage of nonfiction. The word responsibility sounds Victorian, but the ironic thing about DeLillo is that for all his celebrated coolness and pomo intermingling of pop culture and high art and rejection of conventional plot, characterization, and dialogue, his greatest novels, like White Noise and Libra, have never shied away from offering moral judgment and finding larger significance in even mundane events. Here, he shrugs off or simply can't fulfill that mission. Listen to this all-too-characteristic passage from the novel in which the narrator describes Leanne's post-9/11 newspaper reading. She read newspaper profiles of the dead, every one that was printed. Not to read them, every one, was an offense, a violation of responsibility and trust. But she also read them because she had to, out of some need she did not try to interpret. Leanne may not be up to interpreting that need, but DeLillo should be. And given that DeLillo is our jagged poet of conspiracy, of men in small rooms whispering secrets, weaving plots, his failure to deepen our understanding of September 11th is especially disappointing. Instead, Falling Man is just a series of gestures, some contorted, some striking, but all of them infuriatingly empty, nonetheless.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Falling Man by Don DeLillo. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Logorrhea, a collection of tales from imaginative storytellers edited by John Klima. From TIAA CREF, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement. Online at TIAACREF.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure that life-saving advances in health reach those who need them most. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Alice Cooper leaves his mascara, boa constrictor, and guillotine at home and talks with us about creating the character of Alice Cooper. Join us for the next Fresh Air.